Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this briefing from the United Nations in Geneva. Today, as you know, Tuesday, 23rd of March, is General Assembly Day and it's GA Week in New York, so all eyes on UN headquarters. As you know, today it's the start of the General Assembly, and you know that the Secretary General will address world leaders, and we will make his remarks available under embargo as soon as we have those. As you might expect, he will make a speech that will be a stark wake-up call to the world, framed around the need to make clear decisions at this decisive time. And he will appeal for renewal and the urgency of action and moral leadership, asking the question, what kind of world do we want to choose to build together? So, of course, it doesn't mean that there aren't, you know, very important things going on outside of the General Assembly in the context of the UN. The Security Council is also meeting today at 7 p.m. Geneva time on the situation in the Middle East, including the Palestinian question, at 10 p.m. Geneva time on maintenance of peace and security of Ukraine. And speaking of Ukraine, we have our friends from OHCHR here, Jeremy Lawrence, who's going to introduce Danielle Bell. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Michele. We have this morning published a report on the treatment of thousands of civilian detainees since Russia's full-scale armed attack on Ukraine in 2022. The report finds that Russian authorities have subjected Ukrainian civilian detainees in occupied territory to torture and ill treatment. The Russian Federation has frequently disregarded legal and procedural safeguards in occupied territory, resulting in high numbers of arbitrary detentions and raising significant concerns about enforced disappearances. The cumulative effect of these measures, combined with a lack of accountability, has placed many Ukrainian civilians outside the effective protection of the law during their detention and contributed to an oppressive environment and climate of fear in the occupied territory of Ukraine. In territory under its control, Ukraine has detained mainly its own citizens on charges related to national security, including treason and espionage, the report details. Many conflict-related criminal cases also involve charges of collaboration based on the individual's interaction or cooperation with the Russian occupying authorities. We reiterate that civilians must always be treated humanely and can only be detained on grounds lawful under international law. They must be released from detention as soon as such grounds cease to exist. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk calls for the human rights of civilian detainees to be prioritised in any peace talks. That's the end of my little introduction. We are joined from Kyiv by Danielle Bell. Danielle's the head of our human rights monitoring mission in Ukraine, and she can provide more details about the report's findings. Over to you. Thanks, Danielle.
Thanks, Jeremy. As Jeremy mentioned, the report focuses on two very distinct categories of civilians. First, Ukrainian civilians detained by Russia in occupied territory, and conflict-related detainees held by Ukraine for national security grounds. We prepared this report because civilian detention is a complex and often misunderstood issue, and it doesn't receive the same attention that other issues seen in this war do. Civilians in detention face heightened risk of torture, abuse, and disappearances. especially during wartime when they are often seen as security threats. I will begin with the Russian detention of Ukrainian civilians. Russia has detained Ukrainian civilians on a massive scale, disregarding international humanitarian law and applying its own criminal law in occupied areas. Civilians have been systematically targeted for their perceived ties to Ukraine's armed forces and subjected to prosecution for alleged crimes such as treason, discrediting the Russian armed forces, or criticizing the invasion. These are actions that are not considered to be crimes under occupation law. Those targeted include civil society activists, journalists, human rights activists, and ordinary individuals who express pro-Ukrainian views or challenge the occupation through their words. Since February 2022, Ukraine's prosecutor general has recorded over 15,000 civilian detentions by Russian Federation authorities, with at least 1,800 individuals still in custody. For this report, my team documented 508 cases, which includes 216 interviews with released civilian detainees. Let me be clear. Under international law, occupying powers are permitted to detain civilians, but only under strict conditions, including with procedural safeguards and judicial oversight. Russia has disregarded these legal obligations, leaving civilians vulnerable to mistreatment and abuse. As Jeremy mentioned, a core finding of this report is systematic and widespread torture and ill-treatment of Ukrainian civilians by Russian authorities. Of those interviewed, 92% reported torture. This includes severe beatings, sexual violence, threats such as mock executions. One detainee described to us being beaten so severely with a baseball bat that he begged to be shot. His captor instead laughed and beat his teeth with a baseball bat, knocking out his teeth. Civilians also described dire conditions of detention, including overcrowding, food shortages, and very limited or no access to medical care, poor hygiene, and extreme isolation. One woman described being detained for more than a year in a rat-infested cell with almost zero time outside of her cell. Since February of 2022, we've documented 90 deaths of civilians or executions of civilians in detention, and 36 civilians who died as a consequence of torture, lack of access to health care, and poor conditions of detention. Civilians are often detained without charges or legal process, and families are left without information for weeks or months. We interviewed a 70-year-old man who was detained for 3 years without being told what he was being charged for. Civilians have also been illegally deported to facilities in Russia, isolating them even further. These violations that we're describing have been enabled by Russian laws passed in 2023 and 2024, which shield military personnel from accountability. Combined with a lack of transparent procedures and independent monitoring, Ukrainian civilians are left entirely outside the protection of law. Turning to civilian detention by Ukraine, which is completely different in scale and nature, but it merits attention. Ukraine has detained civilians, mostly its own citizens, who are charged with national security offenses like treason, sabotage, or collaboration. As of July 2025, 2,258 individuals were detained. My team conducted 409 interviews with civilians in custody and reviewed over 2,000 court decisions. Ukraine has largely followed its procedural safeguards, for example, ensuring access to lawyers and complaint mechanisms. But concerns do persist. For example, 117 detainees reported torture or treatment when they were first detained in 2022, or most cases were from early 2022. Pre-trial detention is overused and bail is rarely granted. investigations into abuse have seen limited progress. In conclusion, this report is vital for several reasons. First, it confronts us with the harsh reality, of torture, which underscores the urgency of ending it. And the report gives several practical recommendations for doing this. Second, in any negotiation, the release of civilian detainees held by the Russian Federation must be a priority. And the law and the facts in this report provide a basis or can support these efforts. Third, the public record formed by this report can be drawn upon to hold perpetrators accountable. And finally, those detained and their family members deserve for the truth to be known and their suffering to be acknowledged. Thank you very much. I welcome questions about the report.
Thank you, Danielle, for this important and chilling report. We have a question online from Jeremy Lange, Radio France. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Two questions, actually. I'd like to know, yesterday the special rapporteur mentioned the fact that health personnel in Russia was participating in the torture of detainees. I'd like to know if this is something that you've noticed also, like the participation of medics and in torture. And also you mentioned, I think, that 92% of the detainees, the people detained by Russia, explained that they were subjected to torture. You also mentioned that torture is something that is happening in on the Ukrainian side. I'd like to know if you can take a guess and say if this is limited, how many, what is the percentage of people detained in Ukraine that have been reported torture as well? Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy, for the questions. First, regarding have we documented health practitioners or medics participating in the torture and ill treatment of detainees? The answer is yes, we have recorded some circumstances of this, both with civilian detainees and a separate topic with prisoners of war. So we have recorded some instances of this. And at the same time, what we've also recorded is people being denied access to healthcare. So for example, about a month ago, we interviewed a woman who was begging for treatment for a broken knee, and she was kicked in the knee instead. So yes, this is something that we're recording, both the torture and ill treatment itself, as well as denial of access to healthcare and treatment, including as a consequence of torture, which is one of the reasons why we have recorded deaths in custody from torture. Your second question related to both the Russian Federation torture of Ukrainians and on the Ukrainian side. So yes, in this report, 92% of the 216 released civilian detainees that we interviewed reported or provided credible and reliable allegations of torture and ill treatment. With the interviews concerning torture and ill treatment by the Ukrainian side, yes, it took place. The vast majority of the cases, or the 117 cases that we documented for this report, with most of the cases, it occurred during the initial phases of interrogation and in early 2022. But we have recorded some more recent cases. But for the purposes of this report, it covers just civilian detention of conflict-related detainees from the Ukrainian side. Thanks for the question.
Yes, thank you. We'll go to the room now. I'll ask you just to identify yourself and go ahead, Christiana, please. So just for the benefit of...
Good morning. It's Christiana with the German press agency. Could you give us some more details on the interviews you had with people who were or are in Russian detention? Where did you interview them? How do you have access? Where are they now? And that's it.
Thank you, Christiana. First, we interviewed the 216 civilian detainees after they were released from custody And once they came back into Ukrainian government-controlled territory. We also interviewed family members, defense lawyers, and others who still have people that remain in custody in the Russian Federation. So it's a mix of survivors, family members, victims, witnesses. So, for example, you know that we also have done close to 600 interviews of Ukrainian prisoners of war. And because civilians and prisoners of war are sometimes detained together, POWs that have been released have also been a wealth of information for some of the realities in these facilities. Where did we document it? As I mentioned, it's widespread and systematic torture. It was documented in every region of occupied territory, as well as dozens of regions inside the Russian Federation. So if you look at the map that's inside the report, it shows exactly the regions in which we have looked at detention. Thank you for the question.
So can I just follow up? Are you saying that these people who were who left detention were allowed to leave occupied territory, or is this territory that was later regained by
yes.
Ukrainian forces?
Yes, both. But for this report, the vast majority of those civilian detainees that we interviewed were released in occupied territory, and then made their way back to government-controlled parts of Ukraine, and we interviewed them here in country. And they were able to get back. And I would also add that it's different periods of time that they've been held. So with some, they had only been held for 2 weeks. And so these might be people that we've interviewed in territory that's been retaken by the Ukrainians. But it also includes people who have been detained for more than 2.5 years. The report itself covers detention since the full-scale invasion, and it covers interviews that that cover the period from June 2023 until September 10th of this year.
Thank you. So, Nina, and then we go back online to Sotoko. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for the briefing. Nina Larson with AFP. I have a couple questions. I was wondering if you could say the 92% that you found from your interviews, do you think that can be extrapolated to all the 15,000 people that you said had been arrested since the start? I mean, just how widespread this is. And also, you're talking about people who were held for different lengths of time. The Russians, on the Russian side, would you say that the torture continued throughout their detention? Because you said the Ukrainians, it was mainly at the start. And finally, just on the medical personnel, I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about how widespread you found this to be. And also, if you also found that medical personnel assisted, not only took part, but maybe advised in torture, which is what we heard from the special rapporteur yesterday on how to inflict additional pain or seem to be present during torture. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nina, for the questions. So first, the 92%. How do we assess that as being consistent across the 15,000 detentions that have been documented? We assess that as being a reliable picture of the entire 15,000. Why do we think this? We look first at the scope and scale. Torture and ill treatment occurred in every region of the occupied territory, and as I said, dozens of regions in the Russian Federation. It occurred in all contexts throughout the detention, mainly, of course, during interrogation, but that could also be at multiple facilities, but also during the daily routine. So, for example, people being beaten when they're walking from their cell to the dining hall, or being forced to walk at a bent angle. So these are the things we hear consistently. At the same time, we documented cooperation across entities. So FSB, or the Russian security service has played a central, appears to have played a central role in this. It wasn't by accident. These weren't random incidents. And it would have been likely, unlikely or impossible for those in charge not to have known that this was taking place. We also documented efforts by Russian authorities to conceal their identities during the torture, such as wearing masks and forcing detainees on camera to deny that they had been tortured. So overall, you know, these factors make it highly unlikely that it occurred randomly. And because we heard these accounts, like what I'm telling you isn't from one or two people, this is what we heard consistently across the 216 released people that we interviewed, as well as other witnesses. And I think that kind of answered your second question, because your second question was, with Ukrainians, it occurred, most of the cases that we have of torture or treatment occurred in 2022. With the Russian Federation, it occurred throughout the stages of detention, but with most cases, or many cases, being documented during interrogation, which could happen at multiple facilities. Third, on the question on medical personnel, I would need to go a little bit deeper into our notes and our interviews to be able to give a clear answer. But generally, as you've seen over the years, our reporting and findings have been entirely consistent with that of the Commission of Inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got Satoko Adachi from Yomiuri Shimbun online, and then we'll come back to Isabel.
Yes, thank you very much. I just want to follow up on the Ukrainian side. Were there any Ukrainian civilians who died as a consequence of torture by the Ukrainian army or the lack of access to the healthcare in Ukraine? Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to make sure I understand your question. So you're asking, have we recorded deaths in custody of Ukrainians by Ukrainian authorities? Is that?
Yes.
Yes. So this is something that we're monitoring very carefully. While we have recorded instances where persons have died in custody, we haven't verified that they've occurred as a consequence, whether it's occurred as a consequence of torture or of other underlying health conditions. Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel.
Isabel Sacco for EFE, the Spanish news agency. I would like to firstly understand how did you estimate 1,800 people still detained in Ukrainian people in Russia? How more or less do you know, have you gotten this figure? Secondly, on the detention sites, can you describe tell us how many detention sites there are, if there are places that have been set up, especially to hold civilians? Are they separated from prisoners of war in different sites? Well, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel. The number 1,800, this is an estimate by the Ukrainian Ombudsperson's Office, who has documented at least 1,800 Ukrainian civilians remain in detention by Russian authorities, either in occupied territory and the Russian Federation. This number should be considered an absolute minimum. This is the number of confirmed cases. From the United Nations side, we've documented more than 400 cases through interviews and speaking with eyewitnesses, et cetera, and those numbers are set out clearly in the report. But again, these numbers should be considered the minimum because documenting these cases is extremely difficult. In terms of the numbers of detention sites where we have documented that civilians are being detained, those numbers are set out in the report. I believe the number is 161 locations, as well as several dozen unofficial sites. Your third question was the separation of prisoners of war and civilian detainees. You asked, why are they detained together when they're supposed to be held separately? They're different categories. What we have found through the monitoring and reporting that we've been doing over the years, that in many cases, civilians have been detained with the prisoners of war. Thanks for the question.
Thank you. We've got Gabriela Sotomayor online, and then we'll go to Emma in the room. Go ahead, Gabriela.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Michele. I'm sorry that I didn't get your first words in the statement, but I would like to ask what happened with the children that were kidnapped by Russia in Ukraine. They took it to Russia, as long as I know. But what happened with them? Do you have any idea if they returned home or what happened?
Thank you for the question, Gabriela. And the issue of children being deported or illegally transferred from Ukraine to the Russian Federation indeed is an issue that we are monitoring and reporting on regularly. And if you look at our previous reports that we've presented before the Human Rights Council, there's updates set out in all of our previous reports. With this report, it's focused on civilian detention, which is a different category. And in this context, we have documented 9 boys and 3 girls that were detained by the Russian Federation for charges such as spying or acts of sabotage against the Russian military. But this is completely separate than the deported children issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Emma, go ahead.
Good morning. Just a question on the numbers. The 15,250 in detention from the Ukrainian authorities, can you just say whether that is credible for you and if you've been able to verify that yourselves? And do you have your own number for how many recorded deaths in custody you have from torture? Thank you.
We assess the number of the Prosecutor General, i.e. over 15,000 instances of detention of civilians by the Russian Federation since the full-scale invasion. We assess this figure to be accurate. Why? Because you saw during the early days of the full-scale invasion that the Russian authorities undertook massive, wide-scale, arbitrary arrest, targeting Ukrainians who were suspected of supporting the Ukrainian armed forces, suspected of giving information against the Russian military. So there were many, many cases during the early days of the full-scale invasion. These arrests and detention have continued, although the nature has changed slightly. We see more people being arrested and detained for acts that aren't criminal, such as criticizing the special military operation. And not everybody is detained for months and years at a time. Some people are only detained for a day or two or 2 weeks, which adds up quickly, looking at how much time has passed since February 2022. You also asked, so thanks, Emma. And you also asked about the 36, or you asked about the number of cases of torture specifically from in custody. So we've documented 36 deaths in custody that occurred as a consequence of torture, lack of access to medical treatment, poor conditions of detention. And slicing off a figure of how many of those were just because of torture is quite difficult because it's the combined effect. So for example, during interrogation, someone is kicked repeatedly in the head or the stomach, and they have internal bleeding and they're denied access to healthcare. I mean, people, they should have survived and they don't. Or, so it's difficult to give an exact breakdown.
Thank you very much. I'm looking at the room to see whether there are any more questions. I think Gabriela has a follow-up. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Michele. Just a clarification about the children that you say that were in detention, 9 boys and 3 girls, I think. Are they still in detention? or do you know about them?
And I need to check the exact status. So I can get back to you with that, with an exact answer to that. But if I could also add a follow-up. We also, on children, we also monitor children who have been detained by Ukrainian forces. So this is children who have been recruited to carry out acts of sabotage against Ukrainian military. So the child detention linked to the war is happening on both sides. But I can get back to you on the fate and whereabouts and current location of the 9 boys and 3 girls that I've just mentioned. Thanks.
Thank you. Was that a hand up, Jamie? Go ahead. Yep.
Hello, Ms. Bell. Thank you for coming to see us. I just wanted to make sure that, from Associated Press, I just wanted to make sure that I understand this correctly. So 15,000 over the course of the conflict and roughly 1,800 still detained. Is that right? Am I understanding that correctly?
That is correct. That is correct. But the 1,800 number needs to be considered the bare minimum. This is the number of cases that we've been, that Mr. Lubinets' office or the Office of the Ombudsman has confirmed. The actual number is much, much higher.
Sorry, I just want to make sure that I understand.
That is still in detention. So the 15,000 is since the beginning of the full-scale invasion. This includes people who have been detained for days, weeks, months, or years. That's the number of detentions that the Office of the Prosecutor General has estimated that have taken place. The 1,800 bare minimum figure, that's the number of civilians that are believed or that are, have been confirmed to still be in detention in either occupied territory or the Russian Federation. So this is categories like the OSCE staff who remain in detention, the workers from the Zaporizhia power plant, journalists, civil society activists. This is that category. They fall into that category, the people that are still in detention.
Okay, I'm sorry, but can I just follow up? I'm trying to get to the gist of how that number has come down. In other words, is it because the detention was so brief? Like, if you could just walk us through, are there any conclusions to be drawn from the fact that roughly, what is that, 12% of the people that were detained at one point, are still being held, at least minimum? What I'm trying, without getting too bogged down in the numbers, I'm trying to understand what kind of trend or what kind of conclusions we can draw from the fact that there are, 1,800 roughly as opposed to 15,000. Was it simply that most of them were held only briefly? Is there a sign of goodwill from the Russian authorities to hand over a certain number of them? Have some of them died in custody? Just if you could give us a broad overview as to why the discrepancy on those numbers?
It's not a discrepancy. People are being detained and released every day in the Russian Federation and occupied territory. People are being picked up for expressing pro-Ukrainian views, held for a couple of days, couple of weeks, couple of months, and released. So the number is always fluctuating. We did see high, high levels during the early days of the full-scale invasion, people detained for short, medium, long periods of time. The 1,800 number is those that are still detained. So they've been detained for much longer periods of time, confirmed to be detained, but that actual number is considered to be much, much higher. So in terms of trends and conclusions to draw, first, the way that the Russian Federation is detaining Ukrainian civilians is inherently unlawful. Under international humanitarian law, it is required to put procedures in place for the internment of civilians because lawfully it can do that. But it has not done that. Second, it is supposed to keep Ukrainian laws in place. It should be Ukrainian laws that apply. Instead, what they've done is they've applied their own domestic criminal law and charged Ukrainian civilians for acts that may may be lawful or should be otherwise lawful, like expressing pro-Ukrainian views. And at the same time, those civilians who may have been detained on a lawful basis or a basis that could be provided for under international humanitarian law, there was no framework in place for doing so, i.e. Judicial oversight, procedural safeguards, plus widespread systematic torture, dire conditions of detention. So those are the key conclusions to be drawn from the report, is the inherently unlawful nature and the lack of respect for human rights law. So, and then just to kind of come back to the numbers, it's not really a discrepancy when you look at the numbers and the numbers of facilities across the Russian Federation and occupied territory where civilians are being held for varying periods of time. The map inside the report is quite useful because it shows the different locations. Does that answer the question? We can also speak offline. And I can go into more detail offline.
Yes, it does. And I'm sorry, the discrepancy was not quite the right word I should have used. It's more of a gap or just the sort of evolution rather than discrepancy. So let's not get hung up on that word. Sorry. But yes, thank you. That does help.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. And don't hesitate to reach out separately.
I don't know if we have one more question on the matter from Gabriela Sotomayor, if that's an old hand that's up from before. If you have one more question, we'll take this one last one before moving on to our next topic. Gabriela.
Yes, thank you, Michele. One clarification, how many detention centers did you visit in Russia or in the occupied territory? And then I have other questions, Michele, for human rights and other issues. I just wanted to let
well,
you know.
Okay. We'll ask Jeremy to stay then. Okay. All right, go ahead, please.
UN Human Rights does not have access to detention facilities in occupied territory or the Russian Federation, although we have been asking for this access for years. All of our interviews with civilian detainees that had been held by the Russian authorities took place on Ukrainian soil once they had been released and returned to government-controlled areas. And we will continue to request for that access. And one of the core recommendations we've been making in this report and our previous reports is exactly the point you just raised, Gabriella, is the absolute need for independent access of human rights monitors to these facilities, which would be a key tool for prevention. So thank you for raising this important question.
Thank you. Danielle Bell, head of the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, speaking to us from Kyiv. Thank you very much. I understand that we've got some questions for Jeremy. Gabrielle, if you could make that quick, just because we've got some our guests from WHO waiting on standby. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Very quick. Yesterday, there was a release of a report on Venezuela. I would like to know, it was pretty strong about, I don't know the number exact of foreigners in detention in Venezuela. But my question is, if the High Commissioner received the representative of Venezuela or the ambassador or anything that Venezuela could say with the High Commissioner, if you have something to say, thank you so much, Jeremy.
Yes, thanks, Gabriela. I'm afraid I'll have to come back to you on that. I'm not aware of any instances of meetings of late, but rather give a definitive answer, I'll come back to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, and thank you all. We've got Tarek Jazarevic standing by here at WHO in Geneva, and also Hala Kudari, who is the acting deputy WHO representative in Port Sudan. Tarek, perhaps you'd like to say a few words to introduce.
Thank you, Michele, and good morning, everyone. Well, we have heard last Friday from colleagues from ICRC about the situation in Sudan. They also mentioned health situation. They mentioned cholera outbreak. We talked about it as well. So we wanted to have an update. So I'll give the floor to Hala, who is in Port Sudan, and who will tell us more about cholera outbreak and cholera vaccination, specifically in Darfur, but across the country as well.
Thank you, Tarek. Thank you. Good morning. So yes, my briefing today is about the response to the cholera outbreak in Darfur states in particular. As you know, the cholera outbreak started in late July in the state of Kassala and has now spread to all 18 states of Sudan. We have reported more than 113,600 cases and over 3,000 deaths from across the country. And this is really a concerning case fatality rate of 2.7. Over the past year, we have witnessed surges of cases in White Nile and Khartoum, among other states. This is resulting from the impact of the conflict and increased population movement, compounded with severely limited basic services such as water, food, and health. With joint efforts among partners in other sectors, we have been successful in scaling up the response and controlling these outbreaks. The latest success was in Khartoum, where reported cases had surged up from 75 cases per day to 1,500. With concerted interventions to control the outbreak, luckily, the daily reported cases reverted to pre-surge up levels at 60 cases per day. I was actually in Khartoum earlier this month and witnessed firsthand the improvement of the cholera situation. It's a testament to the efforts of deployed WHO and health partners. Strengthened surveillance, treatment of cases, and a targeted vaccination campaign, which resulted in a steady decline of the reported cases. At the end of May, the outbreak reached Darfur for the first time since July 2024. Reported cases in Darfur continued to increase amid severe access constraints that are impeding the required scale of response. According to the latest update, as of 2 days ago, 12,739 cases as well as 358 deaths were reported in 36 of the 64 localities of the 5 Darfur states. This is 50% of the localities in the Darfurs. WHO with health partners has been working diligently to control the outbreak with a focused effort to carry out a cholera vaccination campaign in the localities that are reporting the highest number of cholera cases. As preparations started, numerous challenges and delays were faced in delivering the cholera vaccines to Darfur. Relentless efforts were needed, using all options through cross-line and cross-border routes to finally reach Darfur. The critically needed vaccines and supporting supplies were finally delivered in Nayala in South Darfur state earlier this month. After weeks of preparations to overcome access, transport, and logistical challenges, the cholera vaccination campaign has kicked off this Sunday. The campaign aims to protect 1.86 million people in 6 priority localities of the Darfurs. The campaign started in Nayala Shamal, Nayala Janoub, and Bilal localities of South Darfur, and as well as Abu Jabra and Ad-Dain localities of East Darfur. And plans are underway to launch the campaign in Tawila in North Darfur. Vaccines have arrived in Tawila in North Darfur after overcoming numerous challenges related to distance, road inaccessibility due to the rainy seasons, and other challenges. And preparations are ongoing to launch the campaign before the end of this month. Tawila is of particular concern as it hosts over 575,900 IDPs, mostly fleeing from the besieged city of Al-Fashir. The reports that we have received is of 700,419 cholera cases, alone accounting for 61% of the total cholera caseload in the Darfur states. The vaccination campaign will target 406,000 people in Tawila and is anticipated to curb the further spread of the disease. and complement efforts to control and save the lives of those at most risk. The campaign comes at a critical time, as cholera cases in Darfur continue to rise at an alarming rate, at an alarming fatality rate, to be specific, amid this ongoing conflict. Additional localities in West, Central, and South Darfur will also be covered in another round of an oral vaccination campaign against cholera in the upcoming weeks. The campaign will be a key factor in controlling the spread of cholera within Sudan, as well as neighboring countries, including Chad, Libya, and South Sudan, by that contributing to the health security of the country and the region. Our teams in Darfur are on the ground. They have been there for many years, for decades, continuously monitoring the situation and coordinating the response to cholera, among other health needs. While vaccination is a highly effective intervention, it is only one part of a comprehensive cholera response, including surveillance, case management, water and sanitation, and community engagement. WHO continues to coordinate with partners and other sectors to work jointly on all the elements of the response to control the outbreak. WHO will continue to support surveillance through its established electronic early warning system, the deployment of rapid response teams that will gut, as well as delivering essential medicines that are needed for the cholera treatments. We've delivered over 77 metric tons in 2025 to support established cholera treatment centers, as well as building national capacities to ensure patients can access quality care. We're also working with partners and health authorities and the communities to ensure risk communication, community engagement, and closely working with the WASH sector, which is an integral part to the cholera response. WHO remains committed to improve access to health to serve everyone and everywhere in Sudan. And I would really like to end with a call for peace, as without peace, there cannot be health. Over to you, Taya.
Thank you very much. Hala Khoudary speaking to us from Port Sudan. Before we go to questions, I'd like to segue to Ricardo Pires from UNICEF, who has some latest figures on children and cholera in Sudan. Go ahead.
Thanks, Michele. Thanks to my colleague in Port Sudan as well. Very, very dire situation for people and children. As well, I do have an update on the figures of children impacted by cholera. So especially children under five have been slightly disproportionately affected. We know that so far at least 380 have died. Children between 5 and 10 years of age, at least 240 have died. And children or young people between 10 and 20, at least 290 have died. This comes, of course, at a time when more than 70% of hospitals in conflict-affected areas are non-operational, with health centers being damaged or destroyed during the conflict, lacking supplies and even staff, as well as facilities being often used as shelter. And this is also in addition to relentless attacks on power and water infrastructure that have cut millions of people, lots of them children, from safe and clean water and forced many families to collect water from unsafe and contaminated sources. Thank you. Back to you, Michele.
Thank you so much, Ricardo. I think we're ready for questions. Nina, if you could please specify who the question's for.
Yes. Hi. Thank you very much. This Nina Larson with AFP. I was just wondering on the numbers of cases and deaths, if these are WHO numbers or if they come from the authorities, if you could specify. Thank you.
Thank you, Nina. Actually, we work with the ministry the national federal ministry on a system to implement early warning and make sure that we are receiving and collecting the data regularly. So the figures are a joint effort, and of course they come from the Federal Ministry of Health. In Darfur in particular, we had to work on a specific program that was lighter and that was more agile to work with partners on the ground, such as INGOs, as well as the health authorities on the ground, to collect this data regularly. And we work closely at the federal level here to confirm and, of course, validate these numbers. So I can confirm that these numbers are issued by the Federal Ministry of Health in collaboration and support by WHO.
Thank you. We'll take a question from John Zarkostas online. Go ahead, please, John.
Yes, good morning. I missed the early figures that you were reading out. Do we have the estimated cases in Sudan of cholera and the estimated deaths of all age groups? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. As of 2 days ago, as of the reports from 2 days ago, the national figures have reached 113,600 cases and over 3,000 deaths. These are the reports that are now collected as of the 21st of September, and they are at 2.7 case fatality rate, which is really actually above the threshold of 1%. I can provide further numbers if you need further numbers specific to Darfur, but these are the national figures as you inquired.
Thank you, Hala. Gabriela, and then we'll go back to John. I think he's still got his hand up. Go ahead, Gabriela.
Thank you, Michele. My question is for Tariq, but not on Sudanese and another health issue. I can wait if you want. Or I ask the question?
John?
Sorry?
John, do you have a follow-up, or is that your hand is still up from before?
Yes, I do, actually. I do. You mentioned there will be a follow-up a vaccine campaign. Do we know when, given the urgency, and the target? How many people are you aiming to reach? Thank you.
So, yes, there is going to be a follow-up campaign in Jenina, or West Darfur, Central Darfur, and South Darfur. The actual vaccines are in country, and they've reached Jenina and are being stored now in cold chain facilities in Jenina, and will kick off within the next 2 weeks as preparations are ongoing. With regards to the targets, I will have to confirm that number and get back to you in 1 minute. But realistically, just if you give me 1 minute. I will share this number in 1 moment. I'm sorry to do that. But yes, I mean the preparations are in place and will be kicked off within the next 1 to 2 weeks. I think the hardest part really is to actually get the vaccines there. And I think that has been our biggest challenge over the last few weeks when it came to addressing the campaign in Nayala and the neighboring localities, considering first, you know, there were challenges to reach the vaccines to Chad and from that side. So actually the vaccines that were in Port Sudan were redistributed to serve the Darfur state. And it took a rather extensive amount of time to reach, considering the long routes, the insecurity, and the rainy season.
Thank you, Hala. I think we've got a couple more questions. We've got Nina.
Please.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you. I had one question from UNICEF. I was also wondering if you could say on the numbers where specifically they come from. And then another question for WHO, which would just be on the access or the vaccines, if there's also an issue with the quantities of vaccines available from stockpiles. And if you could say just a little bit more about the challenges of getting them there. What are the main challenges? Thank you.
Go ahead first, Ricardo, and then we go to Hala.
Yeah, our numbers come from the same source as WHO mentioned. They are a combination of our work with the local health authorities.
Hala, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. With regards to the availability of the vaccines, so usually this actually goes to the ICG, which is a group that actually reviews all requests that come from the Federal Ministry of Health. And once it's reviewed, these vaccines are deployed, of course, with the support of UNICEF that transport these vaccines into the country. The quantity of vaccine is actually measured based on the epidemiological data, the need, and the severity of the situation. And usually the quantities are exact. There are additional requests that are being made by the Federal Ministry of Health to the ICG to actually address other locations within the Darfurs as we move forward. As I said, we will be targeting other locations, but with regards to vaccination quantities, this is really covered based on the availability of vaccines by the ICG. And as to date, there has been strong support to make sure that we are addressing the cholera outbreak in Sudan. So that's really on that one. I would also like to add that the Federal Ministry of Health did submit as well a request for a preventative OCV campaign. And this will be reviewed and considered in due time, which will also help the additional to curb the additional spread of the cholera outbreak.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you, Ms. Houdari, for coming to see us. Just wanted to follow up. You mentioned earlier that the case counts and fatalities on the national level. You mentioned that you could break it down by Darfur specifically. Could you provide those numbers, please?
Thank you. Okay. Yes, indeed. For Darfur in specific, we have actually... case fatality rate. So if I may, as of 2-3 days back in Darfur, the number of cases have reached 12,739 suspected cases and 358 deaths. The case fatality rate overall in Darfur is at 2.8. But I have to highlight that we are receiving concerns from, at locality level, which may be higher. The figures also show us that vulnerable populations, such as elderly and under 5, are reporting over 5% case fatality rate, which also shows that these high-risk areas, high-risk populations are really of concern. The most recent figures in West Darfur, if I may specify, are showing a case fatality rate of 11.8%. So also this really raises the alarm to make sure that we intervene both at the response level with regards to the different interventions that cholera outbreak requires, but also to fast track the OCV or cholera vaccination campaign that is planned in the coming weeks. I would like to highlight with regards to the target populations that we aim to reach in West and Central Darfur. It's aimed to reach at least 558,000 people in the coming cholera vaccination campaign in the states of South, West, and Central Darfurs in response to the question that came from John. So thank you. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Hala Khoudari speaking to us from Port Sudan. I don't see at the moment any more questions on this topic. I think we're going to go to Gabriela, who has a question for WHO. And Tariq, sorry, did you have a question? On another issue. Okay, so moving on then. Gabriela, go ahead, ask your question of Tariq, and then we'll go to Nina.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Michele. Yesterday, I have a great surprise because I didn't know that President Trump was also a scientific person. But he said that the pregnant women do not have to take Tylenol during the pregnancy because this is related to autism. Is that true? I mean, I don't know how President Trump arrived to this issue, but yeah, he said that. So, I mean, paracetamol is one of the most widely taken drugs during pregnancy. So maybe half of pregnant women use it. So this is important that the president of USA say, do not take it because it can cause autism.
Thank you, Gabriela. What's your question, though, for Tariq?
That one, if Tylenol is bad for pregnant women, because it caused
okay, great. That. Tariq, let's hear from you.
Hi, thanks, Gabriela. Well, I can tell you what we know about acetaminophen, which we know here as paracetamol. So there were some observational studies that have suggested a possible association between prenatal exposure to acetaminophen or paracetamol and autism. But the evidence remains inconsistent. Several studies that have done after that have found no such a relationship. And if the link between acetaminophen and autism were strong, it would likely have been consistently observed across multiple studies. So this lack of replicability really calls for caution in drawing casual conclusions about the role of acetaminophen in autism. Now, in general, medicines in pregnancy should always be used with caution, especially in the first 3 months. It is important that every woman continues to follow the advice of their doctors or health workers who can help assess individual circumstances and recommend necessary medicine.
Jamie Keaton, go ahead. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. You're right. My bad.
Whose turn
I forgot
is it?
That you. Now I told Nina we were going to go to her
That's
first.
Right. Sorry. thanks, Tariq. I had a similar question. I was wondering if you could say how concerned WHO is about the United States president, arguably the most powerful man in the world, making these assertions. What impact this could have on medical or women's medical decision making, and also in that same press conference, he. Made assertions about vaccines again and raised concerns about combined childhood vaccines. So, if you could comment on that as well. Thank you.
Well, we are scientifically based organization. So we based our recommendations on science. So if you want to specifically on vaccine scheduling, so I can tell you this, that the childhood immunization schedule is carefully guided by WHO and has been adopted by all countries and has saved at least 154 million lives over the past 50 years. The schedule remains essential for the health and well-being of every child and every community. Now, these schedules have continually evolved with science and now safeguard children, adolescents, and adults against 30 infectious diseases. Every vaccine recommendation by the strategic group of experts on immunization, SAGE, and we will have a SAGE meeting, a press conference on a SAGE meeting, I think, in coming days. And that's an independent advisory group to WHO, is grounded in a rigorous review of evidence and carefully designed to offer the best protection against serious diseases and to be delivered when most needed. Now, WHO recommended schedules have age ranges and options so that countries are able to tailor their specific program to the country context. When immunization schedules are delayed or disrupted or altered without evidence review, there is a sharp increase in the risk of infection, not only for the child, but also for the wider community. Infants too young to be vaccinated and people with weakened immune system or underlying health conditions are at greatest risk. And just to conclude on the spacing, further spacing out vaccines beyond what is recommended also requires more visits to the doctor, increases the likelihood that the child will miss a dose, or can result in vaccines being given out of sequence, which in some cases may reduce vaccine performance. So each missed dose increases the chances of contracting a life-threatening infectious disease. Thanks.
My best to keep the speaking order as I promised. So Jamie and then Isabel, and then we'll go back to Gabriela.
Thank you.
And remind me if I forget, please.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, Isabel, if I stepped in on you. Tariq, if you could please just, thank you very much for coming to see us. Just to going back to the autism issue, what does WHO attribute the sharp increase in the number of instances of autism, particularly in the Western world? Is it because of, what would you say? I'm not going to prejudge what you might say, but how does WHO attribute this increase in recent years to the number of instances of autism?
What I can tell you is there are nearly 62 million people living with autism spectrum disorder worldwide. And it's clear that as a global community, we need to do more to understand the causes of autism and how best to care for and to support the needs of autistic people and their families. Now, autism and autism spectrum disorders are among the many mental health and neurological conditions that are being discussed this week at the fourth UN high-level meeting on NCDs and mental health. You know that we talked about it at a press conference. We talked about NCDs in New York at the UN General Assembly.
Isabel.
Yes. Hello, Tariq. On the paracetamol issue also, could you indicate over which period these studies that you mentioned were conducted? And also from the WHO perspective, whether pregnant women can feel reassured about taking paracetamol and in the sense that WHO has nothing to change on this regard?
Well, I will have to look really about a date, specific dates of these various studies that have been done. But what I said is really important, and that's that during the pregnancy, all medicine should be taken with caution, especially at the beginning, and it has to really be done in consultation with the doctor or health worker, because it depends really on individual circumstances and what can be recommended as medicines.
Gabriela, go ahead.
Thank you, Michele. My question is, does WHO has any advice for politicians or leaders in the world before they speak about health issues? I mean, politicians talking about health issues.
Well, we really would like everyone in all communities to really listen to their health authorities. And we believe that health authorities are making the best possible advice for their people, taking into account WHO recommendations that are based on science.
I think there's a follow-up there from Nina. Go ahead.
Sorry, just a quick follow-up. Given your recommendation that they follow medical advice, how concerned are you about the firing of, for instance, the entire vaccine board for the CDC in the United States? And what advice do you think the U.S. president is following? Thank you.
Well, again, we really hope that all national health agencies working on different health issues will we'll really look into what is science is saying, and you know, science is there to provide evidence that guides those policies everywhere. So vaccines are saving lives, we know that. Vaccines do not cause autism. Vaccines, as I said, saved countless lives. So this is something that science has proven, and these things should not be really questioned.
Thank you very much, Tarek. Vaccines save lives. I think that's a very important message. I don't know if we're going to end it there.
We will send notes on Sudan, and also I will send what I have said on paracetamol and vaccine schedule, so you will have it in the notes. Sure.
Excellent. Many thanks to you. If we have no more questions on this topic, I just have a few announcements to make. A reminder that today at 2 p.m., there is, in the context of the Human Rights Council, the group of human rights experts on Nicaragua briefing. That's 2 p.m. in this room today. Tomorrow, 24th of September at 2:30 p.m., UNCTAD, the UN Trade and Development, is going to hold a press conference on the publication of their 2025 review of maritime transport. It's embargoed until the same day at 5 p.m., and Ketain is here in case you have any additional questions about that. We have, in terms of a meetings update for today, the Committee on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights is concluding its 78th session next Friday at 5:30 p.m. and will issue its concluding observations on six countries whose reports have been reviewed during the session. Those are the Russian Federation, Colombia, Chile, the Netherlands, Zimbabwe, and the Lao People's Democratic Republic. The Committee on Enforced Disappearances will begin this afternoon at 3 p.m., and it will review the report on Benin. With that, I just wish you a wonderful afternoon. Thanks so much.